We'll call our first case. It's 22-12-2618, the United States v. Humberto Wentz, Dean Chemerinsky. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Erwin Chemerinsky. I represent the defendant, appellant Humberto Wentz. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court is whether equal protection is violated by a statute that's applied 99% of the time against one race. It was initially adopted with an express racist history. There are two specific questions.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask you this. I'm not going to shout at you, but I've been told that people on Zoom couldn't hear me yesterday.
So oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's going to sound like I'm speaking to my deaf uncle.
I'm sorry. I've got
to keep my voice up. I understand the problem here in relation to the Arlington Heights case. But it seems to me the problem here is somewhat unique because the Constitution itself, and there was some, as you know, at the time it was enacted, and after that, during Reconstruction, there was some debate over whether or not the Constitution was a racist document. But we're talking about a document that protects the international slave trade for 20 years, has the 35th Clause written into it, and also protects the right of slave owners to go into other states, despite the whole thing about states' rights, to bring back future slaves. So with that racist history, how do we try to get a handle on the fact that some statutes, which were maybe birthed in that racist document, nevertheless can be applied in a neutral way, even though, in the words of the Senate report, in the words of Arlington Heights, it may have a disparate impact on some groups. How can you show that the intent of the subsequent legislature, not the original legislature, is in fact tainted by racism?
Your Honor, of course, we can never ignore the racist history of the Constitution. Nor can you ignore the racist history of the 1929 statute. What's crucial is that the 1952 statute was a reenactment of the 1929 statute. It wasn't the new statute.
But the substantial modification of the initial document.
No, Your Honor, I disagree. If you look at the Senate report, 1550, and if you look at page 655, it specifically uses the word, and I'm quoting, reenactment. And in fact, the changes that were made in 1952 were not substantial. There was anything broadening the statute, making it easier to apply. So, for example, they combined certain punitive provisions.
But Mr. Chemerinsky, if I know I'm at a distance and it's very confusing for everyone, but the defendant here was not charged under the 1929 statute. He was charged, in fact, under the present statute, which, if I understand correctly, is a 1996 iteration of the policy against illegal reentry, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, except this is the statute 1326 that was adopted in 1929. The major change was in 1952, but it was then even a reenactment. And here, Your Honor, I think there's a Supreme Court principle that's very important. When a statute is reenacted, even with some revisions, it has to presume that Congress's purpose were the same.
You have a number of presumptions here, or we have a number of presumptions, Mr. Chemerinsky, and several of them pose burdens for you, the rebuttable presumptions, of course, which is what you're attempting to do. But we begin, of course, with a presumption of constitutionality, right, of a statute, and also the presumption that the legislators acted in good faith. Now, there may be some interaction between those two presumptions. I've never had a chance to do a deep dive into them, but you begin with that. So which statute should we focus on here, since the discussion by the district court was mostly about 1929, 1953, and then we have, as was articulated as recently as 2 days ago in the Carrillo-Lopez case, a lengthy legislative history, which brings us up to the statute I just referred to, 1996. What's our focus?
You must start with the 1929 statute, because everything after that was a reenactment. Your Honor, I want to direct you to the language of Anderson versus Pacific Coast, 225 U.S. at 199. It says, quote, "It will not be inferred that Congress, in revising and consolidating laws, intended to change their effect unless such intention is clearly explained. The court said that in United States versus Ryder in 1884, Keene versus United States in 1993.
You have another hurdle here too, Mr. Chemerinsky, for appellate purposes, and that's our standard of review. The district court made a finding of fact here, did it not, with respect to a lack of discriminatory purpose? So in addition to the legal presumptions I've referred to, which become burdens to overcome, burdens of proof to overcome, really, you've got an appellate standard of review here that requires us to find that or conclude that the district court clearly erred. How can we find that on this record?
First, Your Honor, with regard to the Ninth Circuit case in Carrillo-Lopez, its error was starting with the 1952 statute and not the 1929 statute. The 1952 law was a reenactment. As I want to discuss, the 1952 statute had its own racist history. Second, in terms of the standard of review question, it's quite important that here Mr. Wentz requested a factual hearing in the district court. The government opposed the factual hearing, saying this is a case that we decided, quote, as a matter of law. You find that in the record on page 317. There are no facts that were found by the district court other than that based on a legislative record. This court is as good a place to look at the legislative record as the district court was.
Do you think, excuse me, go ahead.
In the subcommittee report, I'm quoting a part, this is from the Greer opinion, all prerequisites for naturalization based solely on the race of the petitioner be eliminated from naturalization laws. That was in the Senate report, I guess, from 1952, the 1947 Senate report, I'm sorry. Wouldn't that be enough to remove the original taint from the subsequent legislation?
No, Your Honor, not at all. In fact, if you look at the Senate report, I'll give you page numbers, the racist motivation was expressed. As an example, if you look at Senate Report 1515, if you look at pages 577, 579, 580, 584, 585, 596, you find expression of racism. If you look at the legislative history, you find Senator Walter George saying that the goal of the statute is to preserve the homogeneity of the American people. If you look at the statements of the sponsor, Senator McCurran, he was expressing racist intent. Your Honor, I think you asked the question exactly the right way. Did the 1952 statute purge the taint from the 1929 law? That's the crucial question for this court. And then you can look at what the Supreme Court has said in cases like Hunter versus Underwood, and Ramos versus Louisiana, especially footnote 44, and Justice Alito's opinion, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. All of those cases indicate that to purge the taint, there's an acknowledgement of the racist intent, and either an attempt to deal with it, or explaining why we affirm the statute in light of it. Congress did none of those things in 1952, but instead, as I said, on page 65 of the report, they said they wanted to continue the 1929 statute and make it easier to enforce the 1929 statute. The government relies heavily, as did the Ninth Circuit, on Abbott versus Perez. But Abbott versus Perez actually supports our position, because in Abbott, the Texas legislature in 2013 didn't reenact the 2011 statute, but replaced it. And I would direct this court to the language from Abbott versus Perez, and here I'm quoting from 138 Supreme Court of 2325, quote, nor is this a case in which a law originally enacted with a discriminatory intent is later reenacted by a different legislature. This case is therefore much more like Hunter versus Underwood, where what happened there was the legislation was reenacted several times with some revisions. And nonetheless, the Supreme Court said the original taint had never been purged, and thus the law was unconstitutional. So you do have clear discriminatory intent between 1929 statute, between the fact that 1952 was never purged, and that the 1952 statute has its own racist history.
What would Congress have to do to purge the racist taint, so to speak, of the original statute?
The Supreme Court has indicated that what has to be done is acknowledge the racist intent. Racist taint, and either take actions to eliminate it or decide that on balance the statute is still desirable even if it has the racist taint. What's so crucial about the 1952 report in legislative history is Congress never acknowledged the despicable racist taint of the 1929 statute. Instead, what Congress simply did was say it wanted to reenact the 1929 statute.
Is there any rule of law, most importantly, I guess, articulated by the Supreme Court, or is there any canon that we can look to that would support your proposition that the first branch under the Constitution is required to make some kind of acknowledgement. And presumably that would be a majoritarian acknowledgement that there is no recent intent that we have in reenacting this piece of legislation.
Yes, Your Honor, there is the general principle that if Congress reenacts a statute, the same motive is to preserve authority. But then second, the Supreme Court has indicated that when there is a racist history, that racist history has to be purged. I would direct you especially to the recent opinion of Justice Alito concurring in Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. I direct you to Justice Sotomayor's opinion concurring in Ramos versus Louisiana. In the majority opinion, I direct you to footnote 44, and I'd also direct you to Hunter versus Underwood. I think all of those cases stand for the proposition that when there's a racist history, the taint has to be purged.
Wouldn't your argument have more weight, Mr. Chemerinsky, if this were not, as I assume that it is, and maybe I should begin by asking you, is this a criminal statute or is it an immigration statute, or does that matter?
Well, it's both, Your Honor. It's a criminal statute that enforces immigration law, but the Supreme Court, in its most recent decision, Department of Homeland Security versus the University of California, especially at 140 Supreme Court, page 1915, indicated that the Arlington Heights framework is to be used.
So wouldn't your argument be more compelling here if what Congress was doing was, in fact, pursuant to an immigration statute, excluding people from crossing the borders into the United States, as opposed to criminalizing activity which is in violation of, in some cases, an order of court, at least an order of an administrative body, often an order of court? Isn't that in and of itself a policy that justifies the passage of legislation of this kind?
Your Honor, I almost have a time. May I answer?
Oh, please do.
Your Honor, what you have to recognize in this instance is this is a statute that is used 99% of the time against one race, Latinx individuals. You're right, of course, that Congress could reenact the statute in a non-racist fashion. But here I direct your court to the language of Hunter versus Underwood, which is exactly on point. There the Supreme Court said, whether the provisions would be valid today if they reenacted without any impermissible purpose is irrelevant. So what you have before you is a racist intent and a statute that's applied 99% of the time against one race. That's sufficient to meet the burden of Arlington Heights.
If I may show you, and this is not, I don't know if you reserved time for about or not, I did a last time, but
we'll play it, Tom, you're on.
And this is not really relevant, of course, to our decision here, which we've got a rule given by a standard review and by our court president. But a concern I have, let me see how you respond to this. I can't help but think that if we were to rule for you, Arlington Heights would fall with the current Supreme Court's view of the Constitution and the law. Why should I not have that concern? Which is different from asking you, why should I not let that concern interfere with my decision here?
I understand. I don't think Arlington Heights would fall. Arlington Heights is from 1977. It articulates an approach that's well established in the law and applies in so many areas. The Supreme Court has used the same approach in the First Amendment context in Mount Healthy versus Doyle. The Supreme Court in the Equal Protection context essentially applied it under Batson versus Kentucky. So I can't imagine that the Supreme Court would overrule Arlington Heights.
What year was Roe?
Well, Roe was 1973, Your Honor. But I think the court felt that it could overrule Roe versus Wade without unraveling a great deal of other law. Justice Alito makes that point explicit in his majority opinion in Dobbs. I think to overrule Arlington Heights would be to dramatically change the law of equal protection, the law under the First Amendment, and much else. Whether the Supreme Court would affirm this court if it rules in our favor, obviously we'll see, but I'm not afraid that it would overrule Arlington Heights.
Let me ask you to speculate on another matter, which is not in the nature really of jurisprudence, but more in the nature of politics. Do you have any doubt, Mr. Chemerinsky, that if we were to strike down this statute, or if a majority of the courts of appeals were to do so, or if eventually the Supreme Court did so, that majorities in both houses of Congress would very quickly reenact the bill.
Your Honor, I don't know. It has been so difficult for Congress to adopt any immigration legislation.
Oh, I agree completely with that. But on my point is this, that the reaction would be so resounding here that it wouldn't take long. Again, I think both my question and the previous question of my friend Judge McKee were in the area of asking you to speculate, and maybe that's unfair. But in any event, immigration causing the kinds of political ripples, and sometimes, unfortunately, more than ripples, I think we're looking at something that would have an enormous impact publicly and politically.
But Congress, of course, can adopt the statute again, but that doesn't make the current version constitutional.
Understood, and I agree with you completely.
And also, Your Honor, there are aspects of immigration law that reflect racism. It's a crime to illegally enter the United States. It's not a crime to illegally overstay one's visa. Would Congress acknowledge the racism that's implicit in that statute and adopt a statutory scheme for immigration that's far less racist? At this stage, of course, we're just speculating, but I would just hope that Congress would do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Scott Meisler on behalf of the United States. With me at counsel table is City U.S. Attorney Adam Sleeper from the District of the Virgin Islands. I'll try to address a number of the points that Mr. Chemerinsky raised with the court, but I obviously did want to get at the beginning that we think that the opinions from the Ninth Circuit this week and from the Fifth Circuit before that in Barcia National Model set forth a sound and straightforward path for this court to affirm the district court here, which is that the court can assume without deciding that the Arlington-Ike standard applies. And that really has to decide just two questions, I think.
The Fifth Circuit made a very strong dissent. It was joined by three or four of the judges there. With a very, I thought, very forcefully disagree with the majority's holding.
So, Judge McKee, there was one judge dissent there, Judge Graves. He relied on the prior dissenting opinion. He had filed in a case involving Mississippi felon disenfranchisement law. But Judge Graves didn't really set forth why his analysis would carry over. And I don't think it would, for the reasons I'll try to explain to the court.
Well, I agree. The history of the statute there in Mississippi is very, very different. Well, I mean, it's not. Based upon what I suggested to Chemerinsky at the very beginning of this, when you look at the soil that gave birth to all of the Constitution, it was written by the end of the Constitution, you do have what many observers at the time described as a racist document. During Reconstruction, these debates came out as to whether or not the Constitution was a racist document. Clearly, there are racist provisions within it. And so it is not so easy to remove, is it, current legislation from that racist birth, racist history?
That's a really hard question, Your Honor, maybe one for more for historians or political scientists.
Well, the Supreme Court has told us not we're supposed to play the role of historians. Personally, I think that's absurd, but that's what we're supposed to do.
Well, I'm not going to trench on Bruin territory of, and I think that let's keep that amendment specific. But I think in this context, I disagree with Mr. Chemerinsky that Abbott's meaningfully distinguishable. I think the Ninth Circuit read Abbott correctly. Abbott gives us, Abbott versus Parrish from 2018, gives us, I think, a framework, and it says whenever someone challenges a law on the basis of legal protection violation like this, the challenger bears the burden of establishing the intent. And you combine that with the Arlington Heights language, which the district court applied here and said, Arlington Heights focuses on the challenged action. And I think it's really easy, and this court can decide this question quite narrowly in Mr. Wentz's case, because Mr. Wentz was charged under the Found In Clause at Appendix 44 and his plea agreement at Appendix 692. The factual basis for his plea is under the Found In Clause of Section 1326A. That didn't exist prior to 1952. So not just the penalty scheme, but the actual factual basis and legal grounding of his charge in this case is under the 1952 law. That, along with the principles from Abbott that we think were soundly applied by the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, make 1952 the starting point. I should be clear, though, I don't mean to whitewash some of the very troubling and shameful statements made in 1929 we acknowledged in our brief.
Well, what about some of the language that your colleague cited to us with respect to the legislative history of the 1952 law, coupled with the very disparate impact it has on folks that are Latinx?
Right. I would refer the court to the Ninth Circuit's opinion. I think the Ninth Circuit meticulously walked through the 1950 report, explained why what the Senate was doing there, some of the parts that were quoted were about the national origin quotas. Some of the quotations, as we pointed out in our brief, were taken out of context because they were basically the committee explaining to the senators what are the competing views on retaining or dismantling the national origin quotas. The nativists did make quite forceful and troubling statements about why this should either be changed or extended to Mexicans and other Central Americans. But what's critical, again, is that that was just one point of view. There was a competing point of view set forth, and importantly, the nativist view did not prevail. At that time, the Western Hemisphere quotas, the national origin quotas, were not extended to Western Hemisphere countries like Mexico and other Central American countries. So some of the worst impulses that you saw described there were not enacted into the national origin quotas. I think critically, the Ninth Circuit helpfully pointed out that a lot of those, that it's unfair in some sense to attribute statements made in one part of omnibus legislation.
Mr. Meisler, if I could jump in here and try to go back to a question that I raised earlier with Ms. Chemerinsky, and it deals with the more attenuated or lengthy legislative history that I see as existing with 1326, really as compared to what was discussed in the decision that is under review here, which really just juxtaposed the 29 statute against the 52 statute. Should these later amendments or reenactments, however we want to characterize them, affect our analysis here? Certainly they did with the Ninth Circuit decision, but is it really quite as narrow a legislative history as was discussed and well discussed in the case that we're reviewing, whether or not it carries the day?
So I think, Your Honor, I agree with the way that the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit analyzed that, right? They basically said that when we have all these other intervening legislative enactments, none of which have been demonstrated or meaningfully alleged to themselves be tainted by racism, then I think the way the Fifth Circuit phrased it was you're farther away from the odious origins of the law. And the Ninth Circuit, I think, quoted that with approval in the footnote. That's one way they're important. And if this court were to reach the second step of Arlington Heights, which I don't think it has to ask whether the statute would have been enacted in the absence of racial animus, basically kind of a counterfactual scenario, then I think, again, judgment, the fact that the statute was repeatedly changed and altered to adjust its deterrent effect absent any indication of racism is a strong indication that it would have been enacted in the first instance for the same policy.
You've leaned heavily, have you not, or did you not, in your brief on Congress plenary authority in the immigration area?
We did, Your Honor. That's kind of a separate argument that you shouldn't even be doing in Arlington Heights analysis.
I understand, but we haven't touched that yet. And if I understand your position correctly, you did that because you don't believe that Arlington Heights is applicable here. Is that correct?
That's correct. But I also should emphasize that we're trying to give the court kind of a narrow path to affirmance, and because the district court didn't agree with us on that, I'm happy to address any questions.
I understand wanting to dance with the one who brung you. That is often effective advocacy. But in any event, I'm leading up simply to the question because I am curious as to the government's position as to just what the breadth of this plenary authority is.
I think that the Supreme Court hasn't fully defined it, I think, as the Ninth Circuit had said in Carrillo Lopez, but the court has given both the executive branch and Congress significant leeway in questions of the immigration law, of naturalization.
Carrillo Lopez didn't even mention it, but they raised the issue, but they didn't decide it. They avoided it.
In which case, Charles? I'm sorry.
Carrillo Lopez, the extent to which the plenary authority would be applied, would gather analysis in the immigration context.
Correct. I mean, so if the court were to go down that road, we think that you could do what the Supreme Court did in Trump versus Hawaii, recognizing congressional and executive authority in the area, but also leaving open, as the court in Trump versus Hawaii, a case for bare animus. It's important to remember that at the end of that opinion, the court said, even under rational basis review, laws that are designed purely to harm an unpopular minority themselves can be irrational. And it pointed to decisions from the gay rights setting, Little versus Evans, and also from gender discrimination cases like Department of Education against Moreno. So if the court reaches that, I don't think the district court's concern here about totally shielding Congress from racist laws would apply under that standard of review. But again, we don't think the court has to reach that.
And you're not suggesting this earlier in response to the question that Judge Smith answered. It sounded like you were going down this road, but I don't think you were, that the mere passage of time would not be sufficient to dissipate the Arlington Heights taint. You're not arguing that.
So I think it's a much harder question, Judge McKee, in a case like Hunter versus Underwood mentioned by Mr. Chemerinsky, where there's been no legislation, no congressional revisiting of the issue. That is the point I want to make clear to the court. Mr. Chemerinsky kind of grouped Hunter with Abbott and other cases. Hunter, and this is quite clear from the case there, the language in the case, Hunter was a situation where only the state courts had tweaked the statute by striking down some of its more blatant and discriminatory provisions. Legislature had never revisited the felon disenfranchisement law of Hunter. It's quite clear from Hunter itself. It's clear from Abbott, the way he describes Hunter. And I think Judge Cooper's decision for the Middle District of Pennsylvania in the Gonzalez-Nania case cited in our brief makes this point as well. So Hunter is a situation where no legislative revisiting, but when you have Congress returning to a statute and making substantive changes to it, like adding the founding clause, like adding an exception to liability that's in 1326A2, those are meaningful changes. That takes us out of the reenactment canon Mr. Chemerinsky mentioned. That's a canon he cited in a case like Keene Corporation from 1993. That's a canon.
Are those changes sufficient to purge the taint, so to speak? Is that your position?
So I don't think it's a purge the taint analogy. It's sufficient to put the focus in 1952. And once you say, what is the law we're looking at? We're looking at the Immigration Nationality Act as enacted in the 1952 Congress. Then that Congress gets the presumption of good faith, and the defendant, the challenger of the law, has to come forward with evidence that that Congress.
So we never circle back to the 1929.
You only look at that under, and this is the language from Abbott, you only look at that evidence to the extent that it sheds light on the intent of the 1952 legislature. That's what Abbott said. And here,
what if there's not an express disavowal of the subsequent legislature by the previous legislature? Doesn't that give some circumstantial evidence of intent?
It does not, Your Honor, for among other reasons, that the legislature that's operating much later in time, many decades later, when 95% of its members have left, cannot be charged with, I think, the knowledge. I can go back to things, floor statements that were made in 1928, 29, or looking at committee reports from 1925. They don't know. They may not know the history of the law. And it would be an ideal world. We want legislators to do their homework, but I'm not sure it's fair to require that.
Do they come up with ways that they don't know the history and they reenact the previous law? You know, arguably, that's, of course, Mr. Chemerinsky's argument that the taint of the previous law should give a rebirth in the subsequent law. And the reason that's given rebirth is not necessarily because of any malevolent intent, but based upon ignorance of the motivation of the prior law. So I'm not sure that helps you.
Well, I think it does where you're talking about substantive revisiting of the law, right? That's, we're not talking again about what he's calling a reenactment, which I take to be just, you know, you moved it from Title 8 to Title 18, you added a comma, you carried it forward. The language he's quoting, Ryan, this is critical, the Ninth Circuit reviewed this at length. It's from a report that predates the legislation by 2 years, and the Ninth Circuit described in painstaking detail all that happened between 1950, 1952, changed this law and made all these changes, not carrying forward, but substantive revisions to the policy and the nature of the offense. I think that's critical. So just focus in on those changes, including, I should say, Your Honor, some of the very pieces of evidence Mr. Chemerinsky relies on in his brief, things like the letter to Congress by Deputy Attorney General Ford, that happened after the report, after the legislation was changed and modified.
And is that the only place where the term wetback appears is in Ford's letter?
No, I'm going to guess that some of the citations that Mr. Chemerinsky rattled off to you were also mentions of the word wetback. But as we put it in the footnote in our brief, I think that's a term that has come to have unquestionably an offensive meaning, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you otherwise. But I also think we should be careful not to judge predecessors too harshly. That word was used repeatedly in judicial opinions, including Judge John R. Brown's opinion.
Yeah, but so was with the N-word. I mean, the fact that it's common parlance does not necessarily, you can't say, well, but back then it was kind of generally accepted, and therefore using that in a subsequent way, it's all right because the animus was removed. I'm not sure that's a very good argument.
Well, I think the question one is one of the context and the totality of circumstances, which is what Arlington Heights says, Your Honor. And I think, you know, the Ninth Circuit others have soundly concluded that alone, even if you view that as an embarrassment or as unfortunate, as again, Judge Cotter did in the Gonzalez-Nanya case, that alone, I think, is not enough to invalidate the law.
What would be then? If using the term wetback is not, what would be enough to invalidate the law?
Well, I think you would need stronger evidence that really the majority of Congress, right? The Supreme Court, the Brnovich case, said you're looking at the intent of the legislature as a whole. You can't just, I think, take stray remarks from certain congressmen. So the fact that certain members of Congress expressed animus on the floor shouldn't be enough. And that's important, right? The principle of the Supreme Court set back as far as United States versus O'Brien in 1967, that we usually are not kind of nitpicking what legislators say on the floor. We do that sometimes with legislative history, and we have to be careful about that. But the costs are very high of putting too much weight on what one person says. We don't know oftentimes why the majority of members vote. So I think we need very strong evidence. Your Honor, talking about what would be the first time ever, to my knowledge, that a federal court holds that Congress, not states, but Congress acted with discriminatory animus. That's never been found before, to my knowledge.
We don't say it's never happened.
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that it never been found. So I think we should, taking that into account, taking into account the presumption of legislative good faith, the presumption of constitutionality that Judge Smith mentioned. And before my time runs out, I do want to just mention on clear error review, we are here on clear error review. Mr. Chemerinsky and I had the pleasure of arguing this issue in the Ninth Circuit in December. I was asked about clear error review. How can we reverse a clear error review? And he relied on it. I had to distinguish it. I had to deal with it. And we embraced that standard because it is the one, whether as a original matter, a court would look at this and say this feels more like a legislative fact issue as opposed to a finding of historical fact review deferentially. The Supreme Court repeatedly, Brnovich, Abbott, Hunter versus Underwood itself. In that case, the 11th Circuit had reversed the district court. The district court found no animus. The 11th Circuit said the record clearly supports animus on clear error review, and the Supreme Court affirmed that determination. So I think we are here on clear error review. If you reach the discriminatory intent, prong one, Arlington Heights, I think that does constrain the court, and we think that the district court below, aligning with multiple appellate courts and almost all the district courts in the country, could not have been a clear error because the record fully supports that finding.
Mr. Meisner, what should we make for purposes of attempting to divine the motivation of Congress in the early 50s as opposed to 1929 from the silence that has been referred to? The choice or the apparent or what may simply be an assumption on the part of Congress that it needs say nothing. What weight, if any, should a finder of fact give to that? And I don't recall that it was referred to at all by Judge Malloy in his opinion, but should it have any role whatsoever?
It should not, Your Honor. I think that he may not have mentioned it because the Carrillo-Lopez District Court, to my recollection, was the first one and the only one to give it weight. And he didn't have a decision before him at the time he issued his opinion. So he did not mention it. I think it should get no weight. I think the Fifth Circuit properly handled that. It basically said it puts the burden on the wrong party, right? We're starting here with the presumption of good faith. Let's say the good faith silence means we're reading something.
So the party, so what you're saying is the party with the burden can't make something from a nullity? Is that essentially what your argument is?
It is, and I think giving reading negative connotations into silence is kind of is another way of getting at the express disavowal requirement that Mr. Chemerinsky is advocating. I think for the reasons the Ninth Circuit gave, we don't think that has any support in law, and it is notable that he's relying not on the majority opinions in most of the Supreme Court cases, but on concurrences. One majority opinion I think he cited was footnote 44 of Ramos versus Louisiana, which struck down Louisiana's non-unanimous jury requirement. And I'll just try to conclude briefly here, but it's really important for the court to look at the context of that footnote in that discussion. The Supreme Court was deciding whether to overrule a prior case called Apodaca that had taken what it called a cost-benefit or functional approach. And the court said, you can't do a functional approach. You can't look at the costs and benefits of something unless you are looking at considering the racist purposes that rule was designed to serve. So history was especially important there because of the context I don't think the court was saying that there's something kind of forever tainted principle, and it didn't again mention this purge the taint problem, which would have been very strange considering Abbott had just been decided. So I don't think Ramos overrules or cuts back on Abbott in any way. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Judge Smith, anything else?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Can you just hold on 1 second? We have to adjust the mic.
Thank you. First, the Arlington Heights standard applies. In response to Judge Smith's question, the district court was correct here. The most recent Supreme Court case about this, Department of Homeland Security versus Regents, 140 Supreme Court at 1915 to 1916 used it. And if you read the government's reply brief in this case, it says no matter how expressed the racism in immigration, only rational basis review, and they just can't be right. Second, the 1929 statute must be the starting point. The Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit erred by not starting with the 1929 statute. The 1952 statute said explicitly it was a reenactment of the 1929 statute. Again, if you look at the report, page 655, it used the word reenactment. The government says that there were substantive revisions in 1952. Actually, it was carried forward verbatim, and all that was done was expanding the scope. In 1929, it made a crime to illegally enter, and then they added found it, so the government wouldn't have to prove where a person entered. But what Congress did in 1952 was double down on what it had done in 1929. Nothing changed it. Third, with regard to the 1952 statute, the question is, did Congress in any way purge the taint from the 1929 statute? Here, I think it's important to focus on what the government just said to you. They said the burden is to show that a majority of the legislators expressed racism. Quote, that the legislature as a whole had that motive. Your Honors, that can't be the standard, because then Arlington Heights will never be met. If you never have an instance where a majority of the legislature expressed racism. In fact, in Arlington Heights, it says you don't have to prove it is the motive, just that a motive was racism, and we certainly meant that. With regard to the 1952 legislative history, the government was saying, ignore all of the racist statements because they weren't from a majority, they're a minority view. Those racist statements show that Congress wasn't purging the taint, that Congress instead was, as I said, doubling down. If you look at Abbott, what you see is there the Supreme Court said that the Texas legislature in 2013 repealed the 2011 statute, didn't carry it forward, whereas in 1952, Congress reenacted, and all of the subsequent statutes Judge Smith referred to were reenactments, and none of them purged the taint. Finally, in terms of clearer, I would certainly argue that here there was clearer by the district court. But I think it's important that the Wentz requested a factual hearing here, and the government said a factual hearing is unnecessary. Resolve this as a matter of law. Well, if you resolve it as a matter of law, we meet the Arlington Heights standard. But if you believe a factual hearing is appropriate, then the case should be remanded. Your Honors, this is a federal statute that's used 99% of the time against one race. It's a statute that originally had an express racist history, a racist issue where never the taint been purged. For these reasons, the district court should reverse, and this is a statute that you declared unconstitutional.
Quick question, what would a factual hearing look like? Who would be called to testify?
We could have a factual hearing in terms of what did Congress intend in 1952, and you could call expert witnesses with regard to it. But your question, Your Honor, indicates why this isn't a traditional question of fact. This is really a question of law. Is Arlington Heights met? It's not a situation where you have fact witnesses coming to testify where there's deference to the district court and clear error standards applied. This court is in good of place as the district courts decide, is the Arlington Heights standard met? Is the discriminatory intent discriminatory impact?
Judge Smith?
No, nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
No question, just comment. Take the liberty to not desire my dear friend and colleagues, but it's rare that we see oral advocacy of this caliber on both sides. It is absolutely delightful to see it. I wish we would see it more often, but we just don't. And I don't know, maybe the experience of my colleagues here is different, but I commend both attorneys. I know you've kind of taken this on the road, and it's not your first rodeo, as it were. But nevertheless, the level of advocacy and the extent to which you listen to our questions, answer the questions, answer them substantively, is really absolutely delightful, wonderful, and thank you both for having me.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to argue before you.
Thank you.
Absolutely concur. And I will ask the transcript of this yes. this argument to be prepared and that the government foot bills those. Thank you very much, Council, for your arguments and your submissions.